Public hearings and work sessions today on for Senate Committee on Commerce. Looks like we're going to start with work sessions. The first one we're going to open up is for Senate Bill 561. Anna?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 561 is the Landlord-Tenant Coalition amendments to the Landlord-Tenant Act. It has a dash 2 amendment, which just modifies slightly the dash 1 amendment we considered last time at our meeting on April 9th. It has a minimal fiscal impact and no revenue impact. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, so what we have are some amendments and the dash 2. Do we need to bring anyone up to discuss or talk, or is the committee ready to move forward?
I believe we have representatives from the Landlord-Tenant Coalition if the committee has questions.
So I'll
Mr. Van Landingham is here.
All right, John, thanks for being here. Let's find out. Does anyone have questions?
Mr. Chair, I'll move the dash 2 amendments.
Senator Beyer moves the dash 2 amendments into Senate Bill 561. Is there any discussion? Any?
No.
Any objection? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move the bill as amended with the to the floor of the due pass recommendation.
Senator Beyer moves Senate Bill 561 as amended by the dash 2 amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Are there any more discussion? Any objection? So ordered. And Roger, do you want to carry this one? Or?
Sure, I can.
All right, Senator Beyer will be the carrier on this one, 561. That closes the work session on Senate Bill 561. We're opening up a work session on 342. And Anna, when you get a chance.
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 342 is the nurses' PERS bill. If the committee remembers, it's the bill that allows nurses to work as instructors even though they're retired and still receive their retirement benefits. We heard this on February 21st, and we have a dash 1 amendment, which adds an 8-year sunset to the bill, and we have a dash 2 amendment, which adds the Department of Public Safety and Standards and Training to the exemption as well, because they have a shortage of instructors as well as the nurses do. So those are the amendments in front of the committee. There's no fiscal expected and no revenue impact. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you. The chair will make a couple of comments. The dash ones is what we asked to be done. We had some questions regarding the duration that this limitation was going to be in effect. I think the consensus of the committee was that we'd go forward as reflected with the amendment that would be repealed on the 2016, and chair's intending to move the dash ones. Regarding the dash twos, this is for DPSST. Those amendments meet the chair's approval. There is not in that particular amendment a sunset or repealing section as we have for the nurses. I spoke with one of the representatives for the DPSST, Chiefs of Police, I should say, actually, Association, and they said that they would be more than willing to have that restriction placed on them as well. It's my understanding that Lori Montes-Anderson, Senator Montes-Anderson, is okay with the dash 2 so long as it does not cause 342 to be delayed. So we have a little discussion to do. I guess what I'm going to do is first ask for a motion on just the dash 1s and get those in the thing, and then we'll come back and we'll deal with the dash 2s.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash 1 amendments in the Senate Bill 342.
Senator Beyer moves the dash 1 amendments in the Senate Bill 342. Discussions on that. That's the one that deals with the nurses and specifically talks about putting in a sunset. Any discussion? None. Any objection? So ordered. So, Senator, why don't you go ahead and give us the motion, and then we'll have a discussion on the dash 2s.
Mr. Chair, I will move the dash 2 amendments in the Senate Bill 342.
All right. So we've got a motion to move the dash 2s into 342, and I am going to open up for discussion as to where the committee is at. Clearly, at this point, this looks like the best, if not the only, vehicle that's available for DPSST to, let's say, hitch their wagon to be able to have sufficient trainers in the program. It is different, as I said, from the dash one, or from the bill now, as it's been a minute with the dash ones, because this part does not have a repeal or a sunset enactment into the dash twos. So I'm going to ask for discussions as to where people are at and comfort level and such. Senator Monroe.
Yeah, this kind of brings my fears out into the open that we're just going to keep adding and adding and adding to the list. Noble causes, noble needs, but, you know, there's a reason why when people retire with full PERS benefits, they're restricted to working half-time. And, you know, it's worked fairly well, and now we've got a long list here. And I guess I have a question. First of all, I would not support the Dash 2 amendments unless they also had the sunset. And secondly, I wonder if staff knows whether there are sunsets on any of these other groups that are already listed. If not, there should be.
Mr. Chair, I'm not aware of any sunsets on the other.
Neither is the chair.
I haven't looked at the statute carefully enough to know whether the sunset that you said, the dash ones would apply to the dash twos if they're in. I'm guessing they don't.
Let's see here. Section 2. Now, it looked like it wouldn't, because Section 3 of the Dash 1s refers specifically to Section 2 of the Act. And let's see where this would go. Maybe it will or won't. Let's see. On page 2 of the bill.
There's no such.
It's a gut and stuff. It removes the whole bill.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So they
just... So it would not.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
I guess my feeling is similar to that of Senator Monroe. I think my comfort level would be definitely eased with a sunset on the Dash 2. I mean, it seems that we've got an issue with PERS, and we just keen to, it's with all things in PERS, it seems like we just keep patching here and there, and it just, that's how the legislature, that's how the system got to the problems that we tried to address in 2003, was that the legislature keeps putting little band-aids here and patches there to a system, and then the system becomes extraordinarily complex over time. And this is another one of those little band-aids. You know, we must have a problem with our exemption if we have to keep passing exemptions to our exemptions. And I would be comfortable with the Dash 2s with the sunset, and you know, I would be comfortable doing it as a conceptual amendment to just insert the same sunset date into the Dash 2s that are currently in the Dash 1s. But that's, you know, that's obviously up to you, Mr. Chair, to whether or not you are comfortable with that approach.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Gordley.
Thank you. I'd be comfortable with the conceptual approach if we have that flexibility in this committee. But with that said, I'd like to focus on the need that's being addressed through the amendment. I chaired the Ways and Means Public Safety Subcommittee last session. And as you'll recall, we moved, we increased and expanded the training hours through the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training from 8 weeks to 16 weeks. And in so doing, we also added some critical training components, including a focus on preparing for acts of terrorism, a focus on working with the mentally ill, another focus on gang awareness and identification, another focus on cultural competency training, and several other areas that I can't recall right now. But in moving from 8 to 16 weeks, what we're learning is that we have a capacity problem in terms of identifying and finding people with the proper skills and expertise who can put on the training that we need to be able to provide through the academy. A good number of the people who are out there who can provide this training happen to be in our retiree workforce. So we need to look at ways that we can get those people back to work and claim those skills and experiences in a way that will help us move our training academy forward. That's one of the issues, one of the concerns. And for that reason, I think this is something that we need to do. And again, if we can move the conceptual part of the amendment, that would be great to expedite the matter.
All right. And I appreciate the input. Let me tell you where I'm at. First of all, I think it's an appropriate expansion only because, as Senator Gardley says, we are putting a lot of demands. We do want fully trained individuals. And I've got to be frank with you. I think it costs the state less money by having these individuals come back instead of hiring new people and having all of the stuff, including PERS, being paid for, which I don't think is part of the cost when you have retirees that are willing to come back and work at whatever level they work at. What I'm going to ask, Senator Beyer, would you be so kind to withdraw your motion that's before us on the dash twos?
Mr. Chair, I would so withdraw my motion.
All right, since the motion has been withdrawn, what I want to do is I want to go ahead and close the work session on 342 with the understanding of this. I'm going to ask that the dash twos be amended to include the sunset date that we have and that were just adopted in the dash one. I would like to have this back on our schedule for Thursday, which it will give us
Wednesday,
and knowing on the time and stuff like that for posting, set it for 3:30. And that way we can move the bill out with the dash twos in there. I agree that I think this is important, and I'm not ready to cross the line with legislative council and take the bold step of maybe being the first and maybe the last chair to do conceptual amendments 4 days out before we get there. Now, if this was Thursday or Wednesday, we may have done it, but at this point, we'll go ahead and see if we can get it cleaned up that way.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
By the rules, I don't know that you actually have a posting problem, because if you announce now that you're continuing this over to Wednesday's meeting.
It's a carryover.
Oh, it's a carryover. That's good. Thank you, Senator Beyer. So the chair is going to be carrying over Senate Bill 342 for its continuation of the work session that's currently going on to this coming Wednesday, which would be the 25th, I believe.
Yes.
All right.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
So, and thank you for the suggestion, Senator Beyer. We'll close the work session again on Senate Bill 342 and continue it until this coming Wednesday, 2 days from today. All right. With that, then I'm going to go ahead and open up the work session on Senate Bill 872.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 872 is the PERS bill for judges. We heard this on April 4th, and there's been a kind of a work group working on the amendments, and there is a new set of amendments on your desk, dash 3, and it does satisfy everyone's concerns on the work group we had, but I'd like someone from the work group to speak to them because they're kind of complex on what they're doing. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, who's the guinea pig? Who's going to be our speaker?
That one.
So if you'd be so kind to put your name on the record and give us a quick overview, and we'll go ahead and move forward.
Yes, Mr. Chair. My name is Robert Rosenthal, and what the work group has done is changed the initial bill, which was to set up a procedure for an alternate payee system similar to what we have in PERS members, and instead adopt an election system where a judge can make an election for a former spouse to receive the survivor pension, and that the pension would then be for the life of the former spouse. In other words, they can keep a current spouse or they can do a former spouse. It also allows, if the judge is remarried, requires the consent of the new spouse. So the bottom line on this is that it does allow a judge who retired, who was married at the time of retirement, who elected an 80% of pension benefit, to make an election after the divorce to continue. And the concept here would be that the court in the dissolution can order the judge to make the election. The election would then be filed with the PERS board. It would then be effective.
Thank you. Any questions? Yes.
And then after he does that, if he married again, what would be the status of his new wife?
If he elected that the entire portion was to go to the former spouse, the new wife wouldn't get anything. However, if he elected a portion less than the entire amount, the new wife could get the remaining benefit.
Sounds fair. Okay.
Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. So the chair is willing to take a motion on the dash threes.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Having just seen these for the first time, I'm trying to read them very rapidly. And I don't know if that person needs to come back up. I didn't catch his name. He was here before.
Yep.
But,
Mr. Chair, I'm happy to go through and show the committee where the change is on the bill.
Just the part that the election may be made before or after the judge member retires. Does that provision make this retroactive also?
Can I address that?
Yes, please, Steve.
Under the current system, the election is made at the time of retirement. The judge makes no election. They get a two-thirds of the current pension. They can elect at the time of retirement to increase it to 80%. They have to pay by a reduction of their lifetime benefit the difference between two-thirds and 80%. At that time, if they were married, they would make an election for their spouse. So what happens is that if there's now a divorce, a dissolution, a new election can be made. And the new election would allow to have a former spouse named for that benefit. If no election was made, if PERS received no paperwork, it would just say your spouse will get the benefit. So if the judge is remarried, then the new spouse would get whatever was elected, two-thirds or 80%. If the judge did nothing and there was no spouse, there would be no survivor benefit. So what this does is changes the third situation where the judge was married at the time of retirement and now can elect after the divorce the former spouse, which under current law would get zero, and under this procedure would get whatever the amount of benefit that the judge elected to give to the former spouse. Does that help you, Mr. Vice Chair?
I think so. In the case of a contested divorce, to the terminology of an election for the judge, could a spouse in part of a divorce settlement sue for part of this benefit and, in fact, force a judge member to sign over a certain percentage?
Yes. The difference between this and the qualified court order that we have for the regular PERS members is that in this case the court would order the judge to make the election. The court, instead of pursuing actions vis-a-vis the court and PERS, the action would be between the court and the judge, and that was what PERS preferred. And the court has its usual powers of contempt and other remedies available to the court to force the election.
So does that in effect then make this provision retroactive to judges who are now married and may get divorced sometime, are retired, and where under current law these judges, those spouses of those judges, have no claim on the pension if they divorce, this would give them a claim on that pension?
Well, I'm not sure I understand your question. This legislation has an emergency clause, so it would be in effect under the emergency provisions. Then if there was a divorce after this became law, then one of the remedies that the court could have would be to order this election. Divorces that had previously happened, you would have to have grounds which are difficult to reopen those to award this type of benefit, because it's treated by the court as a property, and the property settlements are generally not reopened.
But I guess just the last one, Mr. Chair, just make sure I'm clear. Under this provision, judge today, happily married and retired, tomorrow his wife sues him for divorce, today that wife would have no benefit to his retirement. The judge has already retired and has not made any elections to split this, but that spouse could then force this election to a judge who is already retired today.
The way the current judge situation works is that if the judge does nothing, there's a two-thirds benefit for a current spouse. That's automatic. So under your scenario, the spouse would be entitled to two-thirds at the time of retirement. So if the judge had not retired, then that spouse would not get any benefit under the current law. If under the under this law, under the 872-3, in the course of divorce, could be forced to make the election for the former spouse for whatever percent of the benefit the court would deem appropriate, 0 to 80%. It becomes just like in a regular PERS member. If you have a PERS account, you can give a portion of the PERS account to the former spouse. The PERS account has an annuity benefit attached to it. And typically in a divorce, we split that in half right now for a typical PERS benefit in a typical divorce. Sometimes it's less than half, sometimes it's more than half, but half is very typical. So in this situation, the court could do the same. They could order that the election be made for the former spouse for a certain percentage. And I assume the court would look at the length of the marriage, what if people are contributing, the other factors that the court looks at in all the pension cases, typically looking at whether it's fair to give a quarter or a half, depending on the nature of the marriage, or more.
Yeah, let me try this a little more specifically. We had this nice young lady that came and testified that she was married to a judge, and the judge was considerably older than her, and they were now divorced. If we pass this bill with the Dash 3 amendments, would she in fact need to go back to the court and to her ex-husband and have court action to be able to draw on his pension after he's deceased?
Senator, that particular case is currently before the courts. It's an active dissolution case. So they'd ask the current court to take action under the new law, and the court would be able to do that. So she's currently in court at this point.
Okay, so follow up. So she's not, in fact, divorced yet.
She's not divorced
yet. She's in the process of getting divorced.
That's correct.
Gotcha. Thank you.
Any other questions?
But I get, Mr. Chair, it gets back to the question I was trying to get to. If that divorce was settled, would she have action to go back? And I think you told me no, to reopen the case and say, now the law has changed, I want X percentage of the pension.
We normally cannot reopen property divisions that are subject to final judgment.
And if I could just follow up, it seemed to me that the court at the time of doing the division of property would take in consideration what the judge, he or she, would be benefiting from that and offset it with whatever other property that's in that marriage.
Yes, well, the pension is on one party's right side of the ledger and the other assets are there. The court looks at the entire list of assets.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
In addition to what a court may or may not do, it's an important point if it were so, but I don't see any language in the bill itself that shows it to be retroactive in that regard anyway.
Yeah.
Are we missing something? Because it's an important point if it's there.
It's not here. There's nothing that makes this retroactive to be effective as an emergency provision on sign. So it's not intended to be retroactive.
All right. I think that pretty well sets the record on that. Any other questions or comments? All right. Chair is willing to take a motion on the Dash 3s.
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Senator Barr moves the Dash 3s into Senate Bill 872. Any further discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Gordley.
Just to make the point again for the record from the staff measure summary that this bill makes the benefit for judges comparable to other employees. That's still...
That's the intent of the bill, I
believe. All right.
All right. Any other comments? Any objection? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move the bill as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Barr moves Senate Bill 872 as amended by the dash threes to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any further discussion? Any objection? So ordered. And Senator Avakian, would you be so kind to carry this one?
Certainly.
So we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 872. And I think that brings us into the public hearing components for the four bills we've got. And do we want to open up?
Let me see who's signed up for most of them.
Yeah. We're going to figure out where our interest is at and figure out how we're going to move through with those three bills. We're going to go ahead and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 404. Ms. Braun?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 404 allows payment of reasonable fees, expenses, and costs for necessary witnesses and reasonable costs of expert reports associated with appealing a workers' compensation claim if the claimant prevails. It has a minimal fiscal impact, no revenue impact. There's a dash one amendment which caps those costs at $1,500 unless the claimant demonstrates extraordinary circumstances. And MLAC has approved this with the dash one amendment. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. I have two people that have signed up to give testimony on this. Both of them were in the proponent side, and that's Martin Avey, I guess, Alvey, excuse me, and Robert Trump. Why don't y'all come on up, and I just need to name and whoever's going to go first and give us your testimony at that point.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Martin Alvey. I'm an attorney in private practice in Portland, and I'm also a member of the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association. Senate Bill 404 had its genesis two sessions ago and has worked its way through the MLAC process in that time period. This bill became necessary because injured workers were having to spend more and more out of their pocket to develop their complex workers' compensation cases. As the law became more complex, more and more issues became medical issues, which required injured workers and their attorneys to go to doctors to obtain medical evidence and other types of evidence in order to stand toe-to-toe, if it were, with the insurance companies. Because those costs became extreme, sometimes between $500 and $1,000 in any given case, the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association saw a real need for Senate Bill 404. What this bill says is that if an injured worker prevails over a denied claim, then not only do they get their attorney fees paid for by the insurance carrier or self-insured employer, but they also get their out-of-pocket expenses paid for. That was the nub of the bill as it started. As it worked its way through the MLAC process this session, it was suggested strongly by the employer members that we might want to look at putting a cap on those reimbursable expenses. And so through a meeting with all of the parties involved, including the Self-Insured Employers Association, a $1,500 cap was placed on those fees and expenses, absent a showing of extraordinary circumstances. So if you have a case which is really complex, oftentimes toxic exposure cases, lung cases, things like that, that require an extraordinary amount of money to build, would be subject to that type of a showing of extraordinary circumstance. If that showing can be made, then the administrative law judge who would rule on the necessity and the reimbursability of those costs would be allowed to exceed the $1,500 cap. The Dash 1 amendments also do two other things. First, it cleans up some language under subsection 2A and makes it clear that it's not just if an attorney fee is awarded, but truly awards those costs to injured workers broadly if they prevail on a denied claim. So if you have an unrepresented injured worker who prevails on a denied workers' compensation claim, he or she gets their costs reimbursed also. The other thing that it did, and we tried to be expansive and concise, I know that's an uncharacteristic thing for a lawyer to try to do, But we tried to cover what these costs would be. And it covers the cost for records, expert opinions, and witness fees. And we thought by those three terms, we would catch practically every type of cost that an injured worker would run into in a normal workers' compensation case. So it is supposed to be all-inclusive, and to make sure that an injured worker doesn't have to go deeply in debt to prepare a workers' compensation case, if they win, at least they have the prospect of having those costs reimbursed up to a certain limit.
All right. And Sergeant, excuse me.
Yes, I'm Robert Trump, Sergeant with the Kaiser Police Department, and I coordinate our survival skills, defensive tactics, firearms units, and you know our people teach at the police academy in various places. I was actually in a survival, actually a ground fighting defensive tactics instructor course, and in that course I hurt my spine, actually got pulled out of alignment, and so I had to join the wonderful workers' compensation process, and my department was very supportive. My you know, my chief of police actually drafted an email to our HR person, basically directing that they take care of me and that they, you know, it was a legitimate workers' comp injury. There really wasn't much to dispute about it. Nevertheless, the city county insurance denied my claim, cut me off before the doctor said I should be finished going to treatment. And subsequent to that, I had to appeal it, and we won all those appeals. However, I still had to pay $724 out of my own pocket in order to pay for the cost of the deposition of the doctor and whatever else they did. And really, that's the equivalent of being suspended for 2 days without pay for me, for really just for doing nothing more than filing a what was found to be a legitimate workers' comp claim.
And I'm assuming that you never got reimbursed for that amount.
No, sir, I did not.
All right, questions? Senator Avakian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Very good and necessary bill, by the way, in order to protect claimants. I had a couple questions. One, with respect, I'm looking at the Dash 1 amendments, line 14 through 16, where it's talking about the $1,500 limitation.
Right.
Is that $1,500 intended to be an aggregate amount, or is it $1,500, for instance, per expert witness?
It's supposed to be an aggregate amount.
I would, I'm not saying that I wouldn't support this, but I would question whether or not that is an adequate amount, because in some complicated cases, I would think, you would be able to testify about this. Doctors can charge a pretty hefty amount to come show up at a hearing and testify, and oftentimes you have more than one doctor, I would guess, that would be a part of a case. And I don't know if the $1,500 covers it. And I'll ask you the one other question, then you can comment on both. I assume that when we use the term witness fees, that we are really talking about expert witnesses, that there doesn't contemplate any type of a fee for a lay witness.
That's true. Expert opinions in the Dash 1 Amendment under Section 2A, expert opinions is supposed to be as broad as it can be to include doctor's opinions, vocational experts, whatever other kind of expert you can think of that would be necessary in a workers' compensation case. And witness fees was designed to cover the circumstance of a lay witness actually appearing at a hearing. So the $35 or $40 that you have to pay for a lay witness to get there would be under that section of the bill. The $1,500 cap, I personally agree with you, and that was a very much hotly debated and compromised limit that was set over in the MLAC process. And the way that we dealt with the circumstance that you're talking about, Senator Avakian, was to put in the extraordinary circumstances provision that would allow that lid to come off if there were a showing of extraordinary circumstances. I can tell you that my average workers' compensation case is in the neighborhood of $1,000.
Of cost.
There are doctors in the Portland area in particular who charge $500 for a 15-minute conversation with the doctor. And during that 15 minutes, I have to explain to the doctor the complexities of this injured worker's case and then ask the doctor for a narrative report that hopefully will go toe-to-toe with whatever the insurance company has been able to develop. It's a daunting challenge sometimes. But $500 for certain practices in Portland is the basic rate for 15 minutes conversation time with a doctor. Some are less than that. That's about the highest for a 15-minute conversation. So I agree with you that a lot of times you could certainly spend $1,500 or maybe more in just a run-of-the-mill case. But in order to obtain, frankly, MLAC approval, we had to agree to a cap.
Yeah, I think a few of us are thinking maybe we went into the wrong profession if we can make $1,500 or $500 for 15 minutes. That's what, $2,000 an hour.
And, Mr. Chair, if I might, at least one of us is thinking also that MLAC has no jurisdiction over this committee. And I would surely think that we would want to take a look at whether or not that $1,500 was enough. And if I may, just one more question to help illustrate the point. Are there times, and you've done a lot of workers' comp cases, have you experienced a situation where you have to go to the hearing and it might be helpful for you to actually bring a treating doctor to the hearing to testify, but you haven't been able to because of cost, but the insurance company is able to bring a doctor in order to testify, and that created some kind of an imbalance at the hearing?
It has. I can tell you, though, in my experience, doctors live at workers' compensation hearings is pretty rare, primarily because of the cost to both sides. But in those occasions, it's usually the defense lawyers who are bringing the doctors and not the claimant's lawyers because the cost is so prohibitive. Usually in a workers' compensation setting, when a claim is denied, an injured worker is in the most vulnerable position they can possibly be in. They're off work, they can't work, they're hurt, and their claim's been denied. So they're having no income replacement coming in the form of time loss benefits. And so for me to say to an injured worker, guess what, Joe, you need to write me a check for $1,000 because Dr. X charges $500 and I know Dr. Y charges $450, and that's the cost of doing business in this system. They look at me like I'm from Mars. And this bill affords them the opportunity to have at least some sort of a toehold in the justice system.
And let's see, I guess regarding the questions you heard from Senator Avakian, how often do you find that you need to bring in more than one medical expert or testimony or affidavits, whatever they may be in a shape and form, in a particular case?
I usually try to get as many medical opinions as I can get because I'm usually having to have the burden of proof. And so it just depends, Senator Pozanski, on how many doctors have really kind of laid hands on my client. I try to garner opinions from all of the attending physicians who have actually treated my client. Oftentimes, though, some of those folks aren't skilled enough to render expert opinions given the circumstance of that case. In other words, they've treated with family doctors or chiropractic physicians or other people who are more generalized practitioners, and I'm having to battle a neurosurgeon or an orthopedic surgeon. In that circumstance, I have to go off the board and try to figure out an expert to review the file, which in turn increases the cost.
Right. I guess what I was trying to do is figure out if we could put on the record what might be considered extraordinary circumstances to actually go above and beyond, but it doesn't sound like the question I asked was the answer that would give
actually,
us that perspective.
Mr. Chair, yes, a very good question that I think we might be able to get an answer to, if I may. We're talking about two different kinds of doctors here, I think, a treating doctor and an expert doctor.
Right.
And it's very rare for you to be able to afford anybody other than the treating doctor. So, for instance, on a case with a head trauma or something where you might want to bring in an independent expert doctor, do you have any idea what kind of cost that kind of a thing would entail?
At that point, you're up to the doctor's hourly rate, and I think it'd probably be $1,000 just for that doctor alone, just to start off.
Yeah.
So then, in other words, when you go into those experts, those may be considered or deemed to be extraordinary type of expenses as compared to the treating physicians.
I would think that any time that you had to leave the arena of attending physicians, and sometimes that includes orthopedists and expert or neurosurgeons, anytime you have to leave the arena of attending physicians, you're moving out into much greater expense.
Okay. All right.
That answers your question.
Yeah. Senator Monroe.
Yes, along the same line, can you outline the process that you would go through if, in fact, your client had to expend more than $1,500 for the case and won the case? What would be how would you argue to the, I guess it's not a court exactly, but it's like a court,
that he ought to be reimbursed more than the $1,500 minimum or maximum.
The first thing I would do is make sure that it wasn't truly an extraordinary expense. So if it were $1,600 or $1,700, I probably wouldn't have a very good argument.
Yeah.
If that amount got over to $2,000 to $2,500, I wouldn't skip a heartbeat, but to go to the administrative law judge and try to convince them that this was an extraordinary expense.
And so it would be up to the administrative law judge whether or not he agreed that this was an extraordinary expense.
Exactly.
Okay. Well, I guess, Mr. Chair, I thought the $1,500 was way too low as well, but I don't want to disrupt what is a good bill and what has been carefully kind of balanced out here when there is at least that language that allows them to go beyond $1,500. So I would recommend that the committee go forward with the bill as drafted. With the dash one amendments.
All right. Well, we're in public hearing at this point, and I appreciate the comments, and I'll come back to that when we hit work session. Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just need to, on this line of, you seem to have stated that it's going to be a dollar figure that demonstrates extraordinary circumstances, and it seems to me that it's not necessarily a dollar figure because it seems to me like if you have to bring in, if there's only one witness in the United States and that person happens to be in Boston and you have to bring him to Oregon or her, I can see that would be an extraordinary circumstance. But just because you may have wanted four doctors there and those four doctors totaled to $2,500 instead of three doctors that you could have had for $1,500, I don't see in my mind that doesn't seem like an extraordinary circumstance. So is, in fact, this to demonstrate extraordinary circumstances going to be a dollar amount, or is it going to be actually what is required to prove the case?
It'll probably in most cases be a dollar amount, but I think it's going to be what's necessary to prove the case. I'm going to, as an advocate for my client, what I'm going to do is try my hardest to win the case. Usually, I'm not going to go to Boston to find an expert. So usually what's going to happen is it's going to be a dollar amount that we're dealing with. In other words, this case was so complex, we cracked that $1,500 limit pretty quickly, and we're up to $2,500.
Let me follow up if I could. The reality is that administrative law judge, he or she's going to make a decision based on whether it is based on just the total expense of this case, based on what you put on the record as to why it went so expensive, and or it could be because you had to bring in a special individual expert that was, let's say, outside of the region, that, of course, is going to be a higher dollar amount, but also showing and maybe demonstrating that this type of testimony was not available here and it was extraordinary in that sense. So it could be a mix.
It could be a mix. I think the usual case with Senator Breyer is going to be it's going to be the dollar amount.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
The language in the bill is inclusive of a court or board in addition to an administrative law judge. Are there other considerations with the other two?
No, I think what that language is designed to address, Senator Gordley, is where you are in the system when the final order comes out. And so some cases aren't decided until they get to the Court of Appeals, in which case it would be the Court of Appeals who may be making the award of costs. And so if you stop at the administrative law judge level, it would be that person who makes that decision. If you go to the workers' comp board, it would be the board who would make the decision. And as you work your way up the appeal ladder, that language is supposed to cover all of those bases.
Okay. Thanks for the clarification.
Thank you. Any other questions for our panel? Gentlemen, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's all I had scheduled. Does anyone else at this point want to give testimony on Senate Bill 404? Not seeing anybody raising hands or rushing to the top. We'll go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 404. And I'm going to go ahead and open a work session on Senate Bill 404 at this time. And I guess put on the record, again, I mean, it's unfortunately we're at the stage where we're at in this in the session. The chair is ready to move the bill out with the dash ones. I understand and sympathize with some of the concerns that have been raised as to what the dollar amount is. I don't believe us, meaning our committee, is going to sit here today and be able to come up with a quote-unquote better number. To me, it's going to be arbitrary as to whatever number we pick. I think it would be more important to go ahead and move the bill, let it be discussed on the House side if they want to look at anything in difference to what the dash ones provide. And or after the, if the bill is successful and signed into law,
we can monitor it and have adjustments accordingly in future sessions. So with that, the chair is willing to take a motion on the dash ones.
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Senator Avakian moves the dash ones into Senate Bill 404. Any further discussion? Any objection?
Mr. Chair, Senator Byer. Under discussion. When I first I see this amendment, I thought it was pretty clean, and I was ready to support it. But after we heard the testimony, when I hear that the main, or in this witness's opinion, one of the main way to demonstrate extraordinary circumstances is going to be spend more money,
mm-hmm.
that gives me concern as to think that it's just going to be a maybe not an excuse, but it will benefit defense attorneys or the plaintiff attorneys, whichever side it is, injured workers attorneys, to spend more money to try to get over that amount. And I'm concerned about that. I didn't think that's what demonstrating extraordinary circumstances meant in normal language. And I'm not an attorney, obviously, and I don't know if a person, and if this ever gets to the Court of Appeals, if that language will be clear enough that it isn't strictly a dollar test, but is a what I would call extraordinary circumstances where they have to go find somebody, and it's going to cost more than the $1,500 because a certain person or a certain panel is limited and only available in certain for that expense. Not I can get four doctors for $2,500, or I can get five doctors for $3,000. I better get five there and spend more money, and that will demonstrate a more extraordinary circumstances because I spent more money. So I have concerns because I don't know the case law in this area.
Yeah. I would tell you from my perspective, not that I do much because I don't do any more civil work as I did some in a previous life, let's call it. extraordinary circumstances to me is more than just the dollar amount. I think that there is a test. I think there's a body of law where the courts have, in fact, looked at, and it has to be demonstrated that those extra expenses were warranted and necessary. And it is going to be somewhat subjective, but there is, I believe, pretty abundant area of case law when you look at this area, because this is not unique terms. And I'd ask Senator Avakian, from your practice as to extraordinary expenses, if you would agree with my, I guess, summary, or do you think it's more loose than that?
No, I think you explained it quite well. It would be an independent analysis from the actual dollars spent. You'd have to justify the dollars that you spent. Otherwise, it wouldn't be considered an extraordinary expense. But the whole discussion here gives rise to a related issue, which is why I brought up the notion of whether the $1,500 was enough or whether there should even be a dollar amount at all. In fact, I'll support you, Mr. Chair, in the amendment. I would have been more comfortable with no dollar amount listed and just some test that the judge uses to decide whether it was reasonably incurred cost in the production of the case. And the reason here is that when a claimant puts forth a case like this, they oftentimes are having to go in because of the cost with simply a note from their doctor explaining what happened in the injury and why it's related to work. And then what you see from the insurance side oftentimes is two or three reports from specialized doctors in the particular field, such as with a head trauma or a neurological problem. You might have your family physician. The insurance company's got three neurologists and a psychiatrist or something to deal with those specialized problems. So it's very, very difficult for an injured worker to get an opinion from an independent doctor who is a specialist in a particular type of injury, and that is all related solely to the cost involved. And so that's why I brought up the notion of $1,500. Are we really leveling out the playing field here, or do we still have the same problem that we had before the bill? My opinion is, to a degree, we still have the same problem. However, this is a step in the right direction, and, Mr. Chair, I think you're fine moving it forward, and we'll bring it up on the House side.
Yeah. Senator Monroe.
Yep. With response to my good friend Senator Byers, I really think it would work the opposite way. I think an advisor of a claimant would try his darndest to keep it under $1,500, because anything above $1,500 comes out of the claimant's pocket unless they can convince the judge that there were extraordinary circumstances. So it'd be almost like he'd have to try the case twice. He'd have to try the case to win it, then he'd have to try the case again to prove that the expenditures above $1,500 were because of an extraordinary circumstances. I think the $1,500 cap will work to keep costs to that level or approximately that level or below. I really do. I think it would be, it would not be incumbent on an advisor to a claimant to blow up the cost and then hope he can recover by convincing the administrative law judge.
Well, Mr. Chair, I would hope that's the case, and that's the way I read it. But the witness we had seemed to indicate that it for him, how he reads it, and he's an attorney in this area of practice, I'm not, that it's the more you spend, the more likely it's going to be an extraordinary cost, and that's my concern. And if we can set a public record here that that's not the intent, that it is actually that there are extraordinary circumstances, which is, you know, you had no other choice but to bring in somebody who costs more, I would agree with the intent of the amendment, but my concern with that isn't what was testified to.
Yeah.
If it's helpful at all in just clearing up the record, I know Mr. Alvey, and he's shaking his head back there, and I personally have tried about 6,000 workers' comp cases, and I can tell you that within the whole culture of claimants' workers' comp law, the attorneys don't have the money to spend to run up the costs like that, and the claimants don't have the money to do it, and that the dynamic that Senator Monroe explained, that they actually would be working the other way, is the correct intent behind
all right.
This.
All right, if there's no other discussion, I'll go ahead and take the vote. I know we have one senator needs to move to another arena. So is there any objection to the dash one, Senator Beyer?
No.
All right, so that would be unanimous, Brian, on the adoption of the dash ones.
And, Mr. Chair, I would move Senate Bill, whichever one we're on.
404.
Sorry. Thank you, 404, as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Avakian moves Senate Bill 404 as amended by the dash one amendments to the Senate floor with the due pass recommendation. Any further discussion? Any objection? So ordered. And Senator Avakian, I'm going to give you this one as well. I want to give you this one as well.
I'm sure you do. Thank you.
Yeah.
I was trying to shuffle it off to Senator Beyer, but he wasn't biting.
Well, he was leaning, but I figured it wasn't quite there yet. All right, so we'll go ahead and close the work session on Senate Bill 404. We'll be open a public hearing on Senate Bill 860.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 860 increases the number of days from 30 to 45 to foreclose a lien on a towed vehicle appraised from $500 to $1,000. It also increases the number of days from 15 days to 30 days to foreclose a towed vehicle appraised at less than $500. We have a dash one amendment that was on your desk, and it deletes that last part, so it does not change anything for vehicles that are less than $500. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. And my understanding, Senator Decker is supposed to be on his way to be given testimony.
Yes, I believe
on this.
Absolutely.
And let's see. We have Sabina
Shaughnessy's
here. And why don't we go ahead?
Find him to leave. I have her testimony for her.
Okay. Sean, then why don't you go ahead and come up and introduce that testimony. And is this written testimony that's going to be handed out or just read in the record?
Just read in the record.
Okay.
I think she walked away with all the other copies.
Okay.
No, she came back.
She's back.
No, that isn't
her.
Oh,
no,
that's
not.
She was sitting there.
That's not Sabina.
Okay.
Sorry.
I'm so sorry.
But she's still back.
Senator Decker is here.
Okay. And Senator Decker, why don't you go ahead and come on up.
Okay.
We're going to go ahead and let Senator Decker go first since he's in between
acceptable.
Yeah, that's fine.
Assignments.
This time, that's fine.
We have not started, so you get to start, lead off.
Oh. Sam, did you?
No. You're number one.
Well, Mr. Chair, then I, Ryan Decker from Washington County, I will be really brief because my bill is actually really brief and simple. You have been on the towing odyssey, and congratulations to the chair of the committee, Senator Gordley, and Anna, I know you worked really hard, Ms. Braun, on this. This bill falls outside the parameters of that, but it's very simple, and it deals with at least a couple situations that I've become aware of where folks, because of the short duration of ownership in terms of the person who owns the vehicle in a towing situation and the current law, which says that if the car is valued, is towed, is valued between $500 and $1,000 right now after 30 days, and the ownership of that car will then go to from the owner who loses rights of ownership to the towing company. And we simply extend that to 45 days. We also add 15 for cars valued over $1,000 from the current 45 days to 60 days. And, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, that is all done in the spirit of at least a couple circumstances which I've become aware of where you have either a student who is away from school at the time and car has been towed, and then they lose ownership of their vehicle. And we can all empathize with just how difficult losing ownership of one of, for many Oregonians, their most valuable possession or one of their most valuable possessions. And so this is simply a consumer protection bill to ensure that Oregonians retain that the ownership of their vehicle at 45 days and at 60 days, and just bumps that by 15 days in each case. Responding to what I think are, in my written testimony, a couple of good stories of citizens who've been adversely affected by the current statute.
All right. Any questions? Yes, Senator Monroe.
Yeah, Senator Deckard, what's the typical daily storage fee that these tow companies charge?
Mr. Chair, Senator Monroe, I'm certainly not an expert, but boy, they're lined up around me in terms of, I think it varies a great deal. I think anywhere from, $30 is the one I'm aware of in terms of my constituent, Mr. Bruce Markison. But Mr. Cruz could probably jump in, or Dylan Ordonez in my office could jump in.
Sure. Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee, I've seen...
put your name on the record.
Oh, Sean Cruz. I've seen storage fees of $20 a day and $30 a day on invoices on my cars that were towed from my property on the same day by the same company.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
$30 a day is $450 for 15 days. You haven't really gained much. You give them 15 more days, but that 15 days is going to pretty much eat up the $500 in value between $500 and $1,000, isn't it?
Mr. Chair, Representative Senator Monroe, I believe, there's something just incredibly profound about the ownership of a vehicle, losing ownership of a vehicle, and at least the few people I spoke to had a strong relationship with their vehicle, and the idea that one of them was just out of town and found it on one of the last days of the statutory ownership requirements, and the very idea that because of state law, he was going to lose this vehicle that he, and I think in his case, at least the story that he told to me, it was already being moved to a used car lot to be sold, and I just think it was just very, very disconcerting, I can tell you, to that individual, the idea that this vehicle that he's driven, likes, was 2 days away from being moved to a used car sales lot where he was going to have to purchase it back at whatever negotiated price he would have with that dealer to him, and I agree. I just think we should extend those dates to give Oregonians as much access to their vehicles as humanly possible.
And I support this bill. I just wanted to make the point that monetarily, they may not gain very much. I've had a few cars like that I was kind of in love with that I wouldn't want to lose for any price. So I can understand that. Thank you.
All right. Senator, thank you. I don't know if you want to stand around. You're more than welcome to, but if you need to go to other assignments or whatever, feel free to take off whenever.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I hope we pass this bill along.
All right. Who is going to go next?
I will. Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee, I'm going to read Sabina Shaughnessy's, Senator Gordley's intern's, testimony. She had to leave. My car was towed while in the care of a friend, and I was out of town. My friend was given no notice of the tow or information of where the car was after finding out that it had been towed from a passerby. We had to wait 2 days from my return to Portland to be able to find out where my car was and why my car was taken. Retriever towing my car and said the reason was an excessive parking violations. After much protest, I was told nothing could be done and that I was to pay for all of the tickets and whatever the tow company wanted to charge me. Since I was not able to pay the total right away, I had to wait a week. When I arrived to get my car at the tow yard, they could not find it. I could not recognize it due to the layer of muck that had settled, and there was a price painted across my windshield. They were preparing to sell my car. They'd only had it for a week. After paying them, they wouldn't even take the paint off of the windshield and help me to drive home without an unobstructed view. After that week had gone by and I was able to retrieve my car, I had spent almost $700, not including the parking tickets. I missed 2 days of work, rented a car with the added fee of being under the age of 25, had to travel to where my car was taken, which was a two-hour bus ride, and then have it washed and the paint removed. I later received a letter of apology and a reimbursement check for parking tickets paid that I did not accrue. I have yet to hear from the towing company. They had it for 2 days and had already appraised it for around $1,500. I was told this by a receptionist at Retriever on the second day they had my car.
Could you just go back on the testimony where I thought you said there was a fee, an additional fee because of her age?
Yes, to rent a car.
Oh, to rent a car.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All righty. Any questions? I guess not questions since it's just reading in testimony.
Chair Prusansky, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Felisa Higgins, and I live at 5255 Northeast Cleveland Avenue in Portland, Oregon. This is very scary, actually, to be here testifying my own personal issue. I'm here in support of Senate Bill 431 for some provisions regarding safety issues in my experience when my car was actually towed. So I had asked a person coming out of a building if I would be able to park in their lot without... I'm sorry?
Yeah, we're actually taking testimony on 860, not 431.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
So maybe we just hold that thought, and we'll have you come back.
You're
and
signed
testify.
Up for both, so...
Oh, I'm sorry. I've so, only been to Senate for Senate Bill 431.
Oh, no, you're not signed up for both. So.
Okay.
Okay.
All right.
So I'll hold the thought. Thank you.
Wonderful.
Next year.
860 is also a good bill.
All right. All right, so now we've got testimony in. Is there any other questions before the panel's released? Thank you very much. All right, Elkins, and you've got two people with you. And is it Guy Strandbaugh?
Greg,
okay. And then Gary McMillan?
McCullen.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Al Elkins, representing the Oregon Tow Truck Association. I have two groups today of three each, to towing companies, to talk about our opposition to Senate Bill 860 and talk about the impact that it will have on the consumer and on our industry. With me is Greg McCullen, my immediate right, from Race Towing in Eugene, and my far right is Greg Strasbach from A-Plus Express Towing in Eugene, and they both like to give you an overview of what this bill will do to their companies.
All righty. Whoever wants to go first, please just state your name.
Greg Strasbaugh.
Okay, Greg.
Thank you. I'm going to speak out today in opposition of Senate Bill 860. The reason for this is that I believe that the existing law is quite adequate to cover the circumstances that we see every day. I want to share some statistics that I brought from our experience with impounds, and I do want to note there are two different types of impounds. One is a police impound, and the other is a private property impound. We don't do private property impounds, so I'm going to speak to the police impound issue. That's the only one that I'm familiar with. In 2006, we tow for six different police jurisdictions in the Eugene area. In 2006, we impounded 1,499 vehicles. Out of those vehicles, 1,003, or 67%, were released. And our average time for a vehicle to be released is 4.7 days. So of all the vehicles released, 67% of all the vehicles towed in on impounds 1,000 of them were released in an average of 4.7 days. Of the 496 vehicles that were not claimed, all those vehicles exceeded 30 days in our yard. And we have an auction. We don't have a dealer's license. We have an auction once a month. Our average auction price on those vehicles we received was $190. And I share this testimony so that you would understand the types of vehicles that go through the process, approximately how or what the average days are that people pick them up, and the average value of the vehicles that people don't pick up. The vehicles people don't pick up that have exceeded 30 days in our yard are vehicles that obviously don't have much value because we're selling them at an auction and we get $190 for the average price. To keep those vehicles for another 15 days would cost a lot of money for our company because we have limited storage for our vehicles already. And to add another half again as many vehicles to our yard would in our case be over 50 vehicles that we would have to store for another 15 days. The average storage price in our area is $25 to $30 per day. So if you take a vehicle that's been in your yard for 30 days and it's $30 a day, that's $900. And if you add the cost of the towing charges to that, you're going to be around $1,100 as an average. Now, if you go another 15 days, you're going to be at another $450. So when you can see the differential of the value that these vehicles are being sold for at auction versus the charges that are going to accrue on these vehicles, you're starting to get outside the realm of a justification for the vehicle to be picked up by the owner as far as price goes. And also, I think it tells you why the vehicle maybe hasn't been picked up in the first place. A lot of these vehicles are sold to wrecking yards, and we get somewhere around $25 to $35 per vehicle because they're, in many cases, abandoned vehicles. If we were to follow the regulations proposed by this bill, we would have to attain more property at a cost to us in our area of somewhere around $7 per square foot, and that's unimproved property. So once you gravel it and fence it and so forth, you're going to have to put quite a bit of extra cost into this. And for no more money coming back. And so if we're going to increase our expenses by that amount, we're going to have to cut something in our company. And what we're going to probably be cutting are things that we don't want to cut now, expenses that would probably involve benefits to our employees. That's one area that's on everybody's list. We still provide health insurance for our employees. We provide life insurance. We have 401k and a profit-sharing plan. We feel like these benefits bring us a higher quality employee, and we're thankful to be able to be in a position to do that. But there are also expenses that are on a lot of people's list, and as a responsible employer, we'd like to continue to offer those. But, again, being asked to put out more cost and not getting more dollars back for it is one negative thing that I can see from this bill. The other thing is, and I'd like to say quickly, is that it wouldn't be long, I think, before the $30 a day storage fee were to increase to $45 a day to cover extra costs. If the fee goes up to $45 a day or $40 a day, then everybody that's impacted by these 1,500 impounds I just mentioned will be impacted. Even if they come and get their car within 4 or 5 days, they're still going to be impacted financially for that or by that. So for the rare case that someone might have left their car in our yard for over 30 days, if its value is $1,000 or less, for over 30 days they left it in our yard, to protect them at the cost to others, potential future cost, I don't think that would be worth it.
Okay. Thank you. My name is Gary McClellan. I'm with Ray's Towing in Eugene, Oregon. My concern is space. We're an established business. We've been in business for over 30 years. Purchased our property many years ago. I have looked at, several years ago, I looked at relocating. The cost is, for us, is enormous. An example of a piece of property was a couple of acres of a former log pond, mill log pond, that would require lots of work. That property was about $500,000 with no improvements on it. As Greg has stated, keeping these vehicles, we are not going to, the people are not coming to pick up these cars after a week, week and a half. The inquiry traffic at our facility on the phone or people coming in just virtually is gone, eliminated after a week or so. Keeping these cars, the extra 15 days, the 30 days that we do keep them is from the time that the letter is sent. The vehicles were there for a few days before the letter is sent, then the time starts. Once that 30 days is up, our auction may not be for at least six more days. Our auction is every Friday. So the 30-day cars are ending up being in our facility up to 40 days. Adding 15 more days to that would be putting them close to 2 months. I believe that people should be, we make an attempt to notify them. I think that they should be, as the young lady earlier stated, she left her car with a friend. Well, the responsibility is with the vehicle owner. I know when my parents go somewhere, I take their mail, go through it, make sure those kinds of things are taken care of. That's reasonable and prudent for a person to do that, being responsible for their vehicle. If we do move, I would have to make cuts somewhere. Where do I make the cut? Is it the equipment that we've purchased? We keep modern, well-maintained equipment for our employees to drive so they have a safe work environment. Do I cut their benefits? We provide health, medical, dental, prescription, and vision for our employees. Do we cut down on the maintenance on our equipment? What cuts do we make in order to have the facility to store vehicles that typically are not going to be picked up? All right, thank you. Questions for the panel?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
It strikes me that the most onerous thing in this bill would be the requirement to keep the derelict cars, those worth less than $500, for an additional 15 days. Because if they're a higher value car, people, first of all, are likely to retrieve them, and secondly, if they don't, at least you have some value there that you can take back that can at least pay a major part of your costs. I'm just wondering if we were to amend this bill to leave it at 15 days for those cars worth less than 500, but to add the other 15 days for those higher valued cars, that would be something you could live with.
Senator Monroe, thank you. My impression would be that the vehicles still that are the $1,000 and under cars, the appraisal process, and I'm sorry, the statute is ORS 819-230 that qualifies the appraiser to make the appraisal on these vehicles. The type of vehicles that we're getting in are not, I'm not sure sometimes that appraisal process is functional for our industry, because a lot of times these vehicles are not in the best of shape. In the majority of cases, they're not in the best of shape. And you may say it's appraised at $1,000. But obviously, from what's happening when we try to sell that car, it's certainly not worth anywhere close to $1,000. And I think a lot of the people that own the cars are saying that, too, by not coming to get their vehicle after it's been there a certain length of time. Mm-hmm. So that is a mark for me that would seem to be important, as important. Mm-hmm. And we've already given them, as Gary testified, generally well over 30 days to come and get that vehicle.
I've got a couple of questions. Who sets the fees as to storage? Is that by the municipality where you're located? They set what rates you can charge?
Yeah.
And so do you go through some type of review process on what type of basis to have consideration as to raising or modifying the fees?
Usually the contracts are annual with various police jurisdictions. They do vary. In our area, they're 25 to 30 for the outside storage fees. This gentleman earlier testified about two different fees. There are, so at times we are required to put a vehicle inside for various reasons, and that's usually a $5 per day increase. I know of storage fees as low as $15 in our state, and I'm sure there's others higher than 30, but 25 to 30 is a pretty good average, and those are adjusted by agreement with the different police jurisdictions. But everyone in the area that's on that rotation has the same charge.
Right. And then on the impound, I understand you're talking specifically about police impounds. If it was a different type of impound, such as what we heard, where it was a private entity that had you tow a vehicle, they can have a different rate for daily storage, or do you keep or use the same ones?
We don't do the private property impound, so I couldn't speak to that.
All right.
Well, we don't do private property impounds either.
All right. The last question I have is regarding the notice letters. What I heard testified to was that the cars normally are in your possession for a day or two, getting everything situated. You go through DMV or whoever to get the last registered. Last residence of the registered owner, and then you take that, and that's who you are sending the letters to. And at the point of when that letter is sent out, the date of that letter, it starts the 30 days ticking, not the 2 days before. Is that correct?
That's correct.
All right. Any other questions? Gentlemen, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, there will be someone that can answer your question about the private property impound.
All right.
And the next group.
All right. The next group I have is Gary Cole. Looks like, I think it's Dina or Diana. I can't tell if it's supposed to be an A in front of the N or not.
Dina.
Okay. Is it Cops? And then Mike Wagner. And I'll let you all know, we've got about 20 minutes left. I've got another bill. And so I know y'all are here to give us testimony. The thing is, we've already heard from one panel. Unless it significantly differs, I'd like for you to summarize as quickly as you can.
Gary Cole, Retriever Towing in Portland. First of all, I'd like to correct one of the comments by Senator Deckert. The title in a lien sale, the title doesn't go to the towing company. We're required to sell the cars at a public auction, so it always goes to somebody else. In fact, we have auto wreckers that pick up the pieces of something that nobody bids on. I'd like to point out that we've gone over a little bit of the math, that 30 days of storage at $30 a day is $900, and by the time you have a tow, you're over $1,000. The $1,000 figure that's in the current statute for the 30 days, the 30 days and the $1,000 were something that was negotiated a long time ago with yet another Senate committee. Of the cars that we impound, 76% are released before the lien. 24% go through the lien process. During that lien process, 2% of them are released, and that leaves 22% that are actually sold at the lien. So, during that whole lien process, that 30-day lien process, there's 2% of the cars that get released. Of those cars, I've asked many of our people, and It's extremely rare for someone to surface after a vehicle is sold. It's usually a finance company that was notified timely, but they failed to take any action timely. And on the other hand, some of those finance companies do take action. They call us before the car is sold, and once they realize that they have to pay the towing and storage fee in order to repossess the car, then they drop the issue and leave the car with the tower. They're not interested in paying the bill. The circumstances that Senator Deckert mentioned, I believe, is extremely rare. And here we are battling a livelihood of the industry over one person who I understand Senator Deckert's assistant was out of town, didn't have somebody managing his mail, and the car was for some reason towed. There's never been any question as to why it was towed, so it was probably a legitimate tow. Don't know if it was police or private impound. And went through the lien process, and he did recover it in time, but apparently just barely. So we are struggling through this whole bill because of one person who didn't take care of his mail responsibilities while he was out of town.
Thank you. Who's next?
Hi. I'm Dana Kopp, and I'm with Kopp's Towing in Banks, Oregon. We're a small company, and I have done three PPI tows this year. Most of them are police tows. Of my three PPI tows, I will just let you know.
PPI is for private?
Private property impounds.
Okay.
One of them was in beautiful 81 AMC, and that was not picked up. I don't know why. It had two flat tires, and it was left in front of the gas pumps at a gas station. Apparently, they limped it in there and abandoned it. So we towed that at the behest of the owner. They asked us to come get it because it was blocking their gas pumps. We had signage up for that when we took that, and we notified the police properly. The other one we did was for the same gas station, similar circumstance, and the gas, and they had that, and that person came back and they picked that up within a day. So we don't do very many of those, and we have done 175 police impound tows on vehicles between $500 and $1,000 value in the last 60 days. And I just want to go over those numbers with you. Out of those 175 tows, only 10 were picked up, only 9 were picked up after 10 days had passed. Everything else had been picked up prior to that. 37 total vehicles were not picked up. Let me just kind of give you the breakdown so you understand the type of vehicles we're talking about. And I'm sorry, I'm nervous.
Take a deep breath.
So 4 of those were DUI accident calls. So when we got out there, the person was drunk. They had that infraction. Who knows what happened to them afterwards. But the vehicle had body damage, wasn't drivable. So those 4 vehicles were not picked up. 29 of the vehicles were driving while suspended and no insurance. And you can just about tell when you're driving down the road which one of those vehicles are. They're the ones with kind of the dirt on. Yeah, you know.
Those are the ones you stay with.
They're the dented ones and the ones you sit there and go, please don't try to change lanes as I'm passing you, you know. And then 4 of them were accidents. And out of those 4 accidents, 3 of the people made arrangements with us. They just said, we can't do anything. Can we work something out? We don't have insurance. And we did. So 21% of my vehicles were not picked up in the last 60 days. And that's an overall general statistic for our area. For our company to have to hold on to approximately 20 more cars that are not being picked up for an additional 15 days, it will give me an overlap of roughly 15 cars at a time.
Okay.
We're also pressed for space. So I would need to purchase another lot. I've looked into that, and the lot cost would be between $6 to $7 per square foot, and the lot size I would need to cover just those vehicles would be 11,200 square feet, and that would give me enough room to leave those cars and maneuver my tow truck in and out. The number I got was from the Washington County Growth Alliance on the $6 to $7 per square foot. After that, I will have to fence it according to our Washington County regulations, which is a 6-foot fence with a minimum of 3 strands of barbed wire. I called Fox Fencing out of Portland, and they said that would cost me $2,350 per square foot installed to do that, which is $10,810. I'm now increasing my space strictly for cars that aren't being picked up. not cars that are occasionally picked up, never picked up. And at this point, is this affordable for my company? I have 12 employees. We too offer benefits for our employees, life insurance, vacation, retirement, medical savings accounts. So my choice then, because all of our calls are with our county contract, do I petition higher rates on my contract shows with Washington County to increase the overhead on the tows? So basically all these people that are picking up these cars would have to pay the difference for all these people who have abandoned their cars. And it seems like the same people are going to be, the wrong people are paying for this increase. The 15 days, the people that aren't picking up their cars, they're not paying anything. These are the driving while suspended and no insurance tows. The reason, these are the vehicles that aren't picked up. These people buy a car cheap from somebody because their car has good tags so that they're not going to have to register it in their name, and they can get away with driving this car as long as possible without a license. Mm-hmm. And they know it. The police officers know them by sight. They're repeat offenders. They know the drill. And so the somewhat responsible people who maybe didn't know their daughter didn't have a license, and she got their car towed for them, and they're coming in and they're trying to take care of everything, that's the person that's bearing all the cost for these people that aren't coming anyway.
All right. I'm going to go ahead and ask you to summarize if you have anything else that you need to say due to the time that we have.
The only other thing I'd like to say is our Washington County contract does not allow us to start our lien process for 7 days. So our vehicle will sit for 7 days before we can start the lien process. And then, so usually between day 7 and day 10 is when we send out our lien letter. We send that out certified. They have 30 days from that day after it's already sat for 7 to 10 days, so we've got about 40 days there. And we also send another letter by regular mail because we know there's some portion that don't want to get certified mail.
Right. I understand that. Okay. Thank you. Mike, I'm going to ask you if you have anything in addition to share in testimony from what the other five have shared with us.
One brief thing.
Okay, please.
Mike Wagner, Sandyam Enterprises, Sandyam Towing up in Lyons. Sandyam Enterprises sells tow trucks to towers all over the state. That's the other half of our business. We have a towing company. We also sell tow trucks. So mm-hmm. I'm very familiar with towers operations statewide. And I just wanted to reaffirm that the space issue is paramount throughout the state. Nobody really wants a tow truck lot to come into their development. It's not high on their list of things that they're out recruiting to come in. They view it as a wrecking yard, even though it's different than a wrecking yard, but it's viewed as a negative connotation to it in terms of coming in. So in addition to the cost of the property, the zoning is becoming tougher and tougher for us to find places that will accept us in a zoning situation. My other comment is that these folks that are abandoning their cars are typically of limited means. All I see the extra 15 days doing is adding another 15 days to their bill, which gets sent to collection, making their situation worse. So on one hand, as the costs are driven up in the system, the people do pay are going to pay extra costs based upon the fact that that the cost had to be incurred somewhere, so those who pick up get to pay it. And then the people that are left with these bills that are not paid, they get turned over to collection for those, they're also getting a higher number. It's not doing anyone any good to have a higher number of collections for them. It's just increasing the problems they have in life. And I don't see that for the once or twice in the situation where there's an occasional situation where there's a mistake made by someone not taking care of their affairs, that I don't believe that we're serving the public well by this bill.
All right. Thank you. Any questions from this panel? Thank you very much for coming forward.
Chairman Pazinski, I have one other one sentence. On February 23rd, I did invite Senator Deckert to our auction yard, and we were never taken up on that offer, just so he could see the quality of cars that we end up selling at auction.
He'll probably get there right after session. We'll make sure. Thank you very much. All right, I have two other people that were signed up for this bill. That's Jeff Asher and Ron Duncan. As y'all come up, I'd like you to limit your testimony to anything that's different. I understand, I think all of us have heard from everybody as to the space issues, the cost, and all that. And the reason I want to do that, I've got one other towing bill that I want to get up and get on the record before we close for today.
All right, thank you, Chair. My name is Jeff Asher. I'm one of the owners of BC Towing. Out here in Kaiser is our home address, and in Salem's where BC Towing is located. I want to just reiterate 2 points. BC Towing has been in Salem for 10 years now. We're one of the main tours for the city of Salem, and we tow about 2,000 cars a year. The space issue is paramount, what they've mentioned. BC Towing has been looking for a year actively for a lot, and I think we might have just found one and it's what they say, nobody wants a tow yard. I've actually had people go, neighbors buy the lot so we couldn't move into a spot here in Salem. The other issue is, like Mr. Wagner issued, is the cost. This cost is going to be passed on to the owners. If you increase my required space, I can't absorb that space. It's going to be passed on to the person whose car was involved in an accident, the insurance companies. It's going to be passed on. It's not something that the tow company can absorb. It's going to also be passed on to the people who do not pick up their car. And like Mr. Wagner also, it's going to be added on to their liens and collections.
All right. Thank you. Ron?
Okay, for the sake of time, I'll just say we support everything that's been testified to previously. I just want to touch on, you know, what about personal responsibility? If you have something of value, aren't you going to want to make sure that it's taken care of and you put a competent person in charge of it if you leave town? I did run across one case where... you know, somebody called me after about over 90 days. He'd left town and left his car with a friend. Friend didn't have a driver's license. He was towed by the police. Police sent out notification. We sent out our lien letters. And come to find out that not only did he not leave his car with a responsible person, he didn't take the responsibility of notifying DMV of his change of address, so he never got any notification. That's about all I have to say.
Mr. Chair, are there any questions? Yeah, I did have one question, Jeff.
Mr. Chair, I want to point out one more thing. Left out of this also, when a police has an ordinance tow, most of them, if not all, I'm not sure 100%, but I know the ones locally in Salem, the owner of the car is notified within 72 hours. The police send out registered letters, so the people know their car has been taken.
Let me ask you, that's the only other question I was going to ask you. In your practice for your company, when do you send out your notice letters?
BC Towing, we order the DMV prints from DMV on day 5. Okay. We send out our notices on day 10.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions? Gentlemen, thank you very much for staying here and sharing your testimony and being short.
Thank you for hearing.
Mr. Chair, I don't know if you're planning on sometime holding a work session on this bill, but if you are and you want my support, first of all, it would have to be limited to high-value vehicles, and I think I would also be interested in not having it have an effect when it's a police-ordered towing, only when it's a private towing.
I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 860 at this point, and we can take that up as to whether it's moving anywhere and what sideboards it may have. Open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 431. Ms. Braun.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 431 prohibits predatory towing. We have a -1 amendment that removed all the portions of the bill that Senate Bill 116 had covered. -2 furthers that along, taking out the USC sites. And the -3 amendments are actually differing provisions of the bill, taking out the predatory towing parts and putting in the provisions that the Landlord-Tenant Coalition group came together on some language. So we have all those amendments in front of us. I think Norton Cobble is here to speak to the Landlord-Tenant Coalition amendments if you're interested in those. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you. I have three people that are signed up for this bill at this point, and Felisa, why don't you come on back up, and then I have Norton Cable.
All three.
Why don't you come on up?
Yeah.
And then Sean, you're up the third one.
Chair Prasansky, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Felisa Higgins, and I'd like to first start out by apologizing for my earlier mistake.
Don't worry about it.
I feel officially embarrassed right now. The reason why I'm here testifying on support of Senate Bill 431 is some of the safety provisions that are in the bill and the timelines around picking up your vehicle. I was in a situation probably about a year and a half ago where my car was towed late in the evening, and it was about 1 o'clock at night, and I had pledged to be the designated driver for a group of friends, so I promptly put them in cabs to their various homes and then got on the bus to go and collect my car at the Retriever towing lot that is underneath the 405 bridge in northwest Portland. I had called the lot to say that I was on my way. I estimated that I was going to arrive at about 2 o'clock in the morning, but I had gotten there earlier than I expected.
So I then proceeded to wait underneath the 405 bridge. And I don't know if any of you have been under a freeway bridge in the middle of the night, but it's not a pleasant experience, especially for a woman. And it was, it felt very dangerous to me, even though I do feel Portland is a safe city. Being underneath a freeway in the middle of the night is something that I would not like to repeat in my experiences. So I then proceeded to continue to call the towing company to ask them if they could send somebody earlier because I was standing underneath the freeway in the middle of the night. And they actually arrived a half an hour late. So during this time period, you know, nothing happened to me, thank goodness, but, there, you know, it was a situation where there were cars who were coming by and would slow down. There were homeless people who were, wandering the streets, and which is not necessarily a dangerous situation, but it can be. And so I think that this bill is really important in eliminating that situation for people, that there's times, even if you do have a time that you're setting up with a company to come and retrieve your car, that if you are in a dangerous situation, then they need to come and get you your car, or at least send somebody to be with you until somebody can come and release your car, as well as the importance of just making sure that that you are allowed to have your car in a timely manner. So thank you, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
All right. Norton.
Chairman Brzezinski and members of the committee, my name is Norton Cabell. I live in Eugene. I'm the legislative director of Oregon Rental Housing Association, a landlord trade group. For the past 10 years or so, I've been a member of the Landlord Tenant Coalition, and I want to thank you for your efforts, however brief, however fleeting a few moments ago, to deal with Senate Bill 561. That one took a lot of work. Earlier this session, when a number of towing bills were being considered that would affect landlords and tenants, several members of the legislature asked the coalition to look at that issue. And while time was short, we did that. We invited the interested parties, including sponsors of the several bills, members of the Senate Bill 116 work group, representatives of tow companies, to explain the problems and abuses that they saw. Over three work sessions, we discussed those problems as they pertain to residential property. We didn't see solutions that would prevent a tenant's car from ever being towed while still preserving the landlord's right to be able to keep emergency areas clear and keep cars from blocking others and the like. A subgroup of the coalition worked on coming up with a compromise, which is what our coalition is all about, and we did that. The compromise has four elements. One is that a landlord may continue to tow vehicles without notice when they're parked in handicapped spots or no parking areas or emergency access areas and the like. Second, a landlord may never tow a vehicle solely because it's not properly registered registered or licensed, and that would be new. Third, before towing a tenant's vehicle for other reasons, a landlord must give prior notice. And then fourth, a landlord can't tow a tenant's vehicle solely because it doesn't have the appropriate tags or stickers unless there's a clear written rental agreement, a clear written agreement with the tenant that enables that. So those are the elements of the compromise that the coalition came up with, and unfortunately, Senate Bill 431 doesn't quite do that. The biggest problem is that 431 puts all of this in Chapter 98, which is the chapter which deals with towing. And so that covers everybody, and it doesn't define landlord, it doesn't define tenant, it doesn't define notice, it doesn't do a bunch of stuff. All of that stuff is in Chapter 90, of course, but not in Chapter 98. So I think this bill, as it's written, would cover shopping centers and other kinds of places where there are public parking. And I don't know, you know, giving notice, for example, to tenants in a shopping center is not going to help the owner of the car particularly, because the tenant is the store. I think that's a major concern, is where this was put. And we also, the Landlord-Tenant Coalition, has no expertise when it comes to parking other than in residential, you know, apartment complexes. And so we're very nervous about endorsing something that would extend beyond where we feel our purview is. We also did some other things that got left out of this bill. We required, our compromise required a written agreement between the landlord and a tenant, while this bill, I'm talking about the Dash 3 amendments. While the Dash 3 amendments just requires a notice, and our tenant advocates in the coalition were nervous because landlords have to have tenants go through a lot of paperwork. Mine is about 10 or 12 pages long of different forms and paperwork and whatnot. And it's easy for stuff to get lost. And so our agreement was this would have to be a separate agreement signed by the tenant was our coalition agreement. And that at least puts the tenant on more notice about what the consequences of not complying with the parking rules would be. We also left out of the notice that the agreement that the tenant would sign at the beginning, the actual rates that are being charged. We went back and forth on that, but in the end found that the complications of continuing to update people on rates was outweighed by the fact that by the time this actually happens 2 years into their tenancy, they will have forgotten all that stuff they signed anyway. And besides which, we see all of that being covered better by Senate Bill 116. So with some work, the coalition supports Senate Bill 431. Dash 3 amendments. We oppose the Dash 2 amendments.
Sean?
Yes, Chair Pazansky, members of the committee, Sean Cruz, Senator Gordley's Chief of Staff. This legislation arises out of safety issues, and the practice of patrol towing is illegal in many other states, including California and Washington. And those laws have already been reached the U.S. Court of Appeals, which has upheld, and I have you have the handouts there that describe that. Where the crux of the issue is the way patrol towing is done in Oregon without any regulation whatsoever is the towing decisions are left to a tow truck driver working on a commission basis. And you know where all the judgment calls are going to go in that situation. In my personal experience, where tow truck drivers have trespassed on my property typically about 5:30 in the morning and stolen my vehicle. In the 2 years that this has been going on, the most recent time being a couple weeks ago, the tow companies have changed, different drivers, the apartment managers next door have changed, and the apartment management companies have changed. But what has not changed is the landlord's arrangement with patrol towers and the result of those arrangements. In the U.S. Court of Appeals, if you look at the second to the last page, I've marked the passage down there, and it says, these ordinances protect both the vehicle owner and the public from towing mistakes, which may lead to dangerous confrontations, to the owner and his or her family being stranded at a dangerous time and location, which is illustrated by Ms. Hagen's testimony, to false vehicle theft reports, you know, and I've had to notify the police and take up their time each time my car disappears, which waste law enforcement's limited resources and are a burden on the public, to unnecessary hazardous tows, which Marion Gaylord from the City of Portland has described this concern as towers in such a hurry to escape with your vehicle that they drag it off before they've attached the safety equipment, take it around the corner where they can't be spotted, and that's where they attach the safety equipment. And to similarly unsafe circumstances, the ordinance also protects against theft of vehicles from private property, which has happened to me 4 times.
Questions?
Yeah, sure.
Didn't Senate Bill 116 pretty much deal with predatory towing and restricted? Of course, it hasn't passed all the way through, but it's passed the Senate.
Mr. Chair?
Oh, no. Go ahead and get it over.
What I would like to point out at this point, given the time constraints, is that the original Senate Bill 431 on page 4, section 11, sub 2, line 21,
contains the crux of the issue from where my office sits. California and Washington have banned predatory patrol towing. It is my belief, based on the experiences, the many dozens of experiences that have been shared with my office in the form of complaints, is my belief that what we need to do in Oregon is put in place a similar ban on predatory patrol towing. The Dash 3 amendments represent a lot of good work, hard work. I support them, but they don't go far enough. What's missing is the outright ban on predatory patrol towing. And that's what I would like the committee to be aware of and to address, and would like some more time to massage the bill to deal with the other problem that's been pointed out about the different chapters, 90 and 98, and bringing that piece together. But the issue, the opportunity is to ban predatory patrol towing in this state. We have a problem within the industry that needs to be an unregulated industry that needs to be addressed.
If I may, Chair Prusansky, members of the committee, California and Washington have solved the problem simply by requiring the landlord or the property manager or their agent to be present at the time of the tow and sign the invoice.
The language on page 4, lines 21 through 24, is the same language that you'll find in the California and the Washington statutes.
And just so the committee knows, the Dash 2 amendments is the Section 11 of Senate Bill 431, taking out everything else in Senate Bill 431. So what Senator Gorley is talking about is Section 11, that is the Dash 2 amendments. The Dash 3 amendments are the Landlord-Tenant Coalition.
Thank you.
So the Dash 2 amendments ban patrol towing.
Right. So the Dash 2s would basically, if that was adopted, the Dash 3s would be in conflict.
Right, they are in conflict. So you wouldn't adopt both of them. They're the same. They were intended to be the same section.
All right, I'm going to go ahead, unless there's another question. Senator Beyer?
I do. I just want to make sure, Norton, right?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. You said that the wrong chapter of law is amended. It doesn't exactly reflect the agreement you reached in your landlord-tenant coalition, but you support and want to move forward?
I said with some massaging and fixing of some of those problems that I mentioned. We support the concept, but it didn't get done right. So we would like to move to Chapter 90, the stuff that applies to residential property, the stuff that we propose that applies to residential property, because we don't think it's applicable in commercial context.
Okay, this is just clarification, but would that fit into the relating to clause of this bill?
Probably not. That's probably why it's put in Chapter
90. I don't know if it would or wouldn't. I don't know what the relating clause would need to be for ORS 90.
I don't either, Mr. Chair.
So maybe that's something that needs to be checked on. I mean, time is of the essence, let's say, as they say in the legal world, knowing that Monday, a week from today, is the last day that we have to move bills. Understand what the Dash 2s will do. I guess the thing is,
Mr. Chairman, if I may, I believe that the Dash 2s moot pretty much Dash 3 because they require the actual presence of the landlord in order to authorize any tow. So all of the rest of our suggestions would be mooted.
I understand that. What I also see is that both of the amendments says they are referring to ORS 98. And what I heard from the testimony is that that is much more broader and let's say expansive as to these type of tows beyond the residential type of settings, where if it was a 90, it would be limited there. And so the question really before I think our committee is whether we want to take an approach that Washington State and California has taken about basically going away from any type of patrol towing as it must be defined, which means, I guess, the person who's under a contract can go out and find them and hook them up without any verification of the people who they've entered the contracts with or their agents being on the scene or on site when they actually do the towing, as compared to, and that would be, from what I've heard from the testimony, not only at residential complexes, but also could be in commercial areas such as shopping malls. And so that's something I think we need to think about. So with that, I'm going to go ahead and close the, well, before I close the public hearing, even though we're after hours, I am going to ask, was there anyone else who wanted to give testimony on Senate Bill 431? Not seeing one. We'll close that public hearing, and we're adjourned for the day. Thank you.
Honor, thank you for your work on this.
You're welcome.
You've been magnificent.